Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Richard Skipper celebrates the best in entertainment. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique, never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Friday, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of Richard Skipper Celebrates. What are you celebrating today? For those of you who are here for the first time, welcome. My show is about celebrating. It's about celebrating life, celebrating art, celebrating artists, celebrating whatever it is that you can find to celebrate. And I believe that if you take the time, there's something to celebrate in every corner of the world, no matter what. I am so excited to welcome to our show today, David Leopold, who is the curator of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. And I have to tell you, when I was a kid growing up in Conway, South Carolina, I was familiar with Al Hirschfeld. I used to go to the library. My parents would drop me off every Saturday afternoon. And my first stop would be to go to the New York Times. And I would grab the Times and I would go to the preceding week's New York Times and I would look for the Hirschfeld. And especially at the beginning of the Broadway season, where he would have a compilation of all of these shows that would be coming in that season. And it was always very exciting for me. And then I learned about the Ninas. So that was an exciting thing to go in and count the Ninas and get there. I knew about this long before I came to New York. And then years later, I got the great pleasure of meeting Hirschfeld. I was introduced to him by my dear friend, Carol Channing, and that was a great honor. And it's a great honor for me today to welcome David Leopold to the show. And before we delve into all the work that you're doing now, I want to say, first of all, besides what we're going to talk about today, what are you celebrating?
Well, I'm just celebrating that I get to do this work for a living. I'm celebrating all the people who love Hirschfeld's work, and we find new ways of sharing it with them, showing them things that they are looking for, and then showing them things that they didn't know existed.
Now, David, I want to ask you, because I grew up in a small town, very small town.
Me
in
too.
South Carolina. Where did you grow up?
Don't hold it against me, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I was the same way as you. Sunday, my parents subscribed to the Times, and I was one of five children. When the Times hit the doorstep, it was a race to see who was going to be the first one. We went right for the Hirschfelds, and we were looking for Ninas. And it was years before I finally said, who are these people he's drawing? Mm-hmm. And that started a whole new chapter in my life.
So you're saying that originally you thought they were just drawings. You didn't realize that they were drawings of real, honest to God, living people.
I didn't really put any thought. I was 8 or 9 years old, and they just were fascinating to me. And my parents had, you know, it's like an initiation rite when you learn about looking for Ninas. It's sort of like an initiation rite into Broadway and show business in general. And we learned, you know, first it was just, I want to find if it's in the hair or the dress or whatnot. And then we were like, who is this Rex Harrison person? And who is this Carol Channing? And who, you know, that was fascinating to me because they usually accompany, you know, by the time I started looking at Hirschfeld drawings, they almost always accompanied articles. So I would read the article more interested than if I'd just seen the headline. Mm-hmm. I want to know what can this tell me about this drawing? And it was really the beginning of a lifelong, ongoing fascination with all things related to performing arts and really the visual arts as well.
Now, I learned something new about you today. I learned that you are a twin.
Oh my gosh.
I asked for a photograph of you at 5 years old. Right. You said you could not understand why. I'm going to show, first of all, the photograph. Now, did you figure out, is this you or is this your twin brother?
No, that's what you have to understand is nobody knows.
Nobody knows?
I don't. My brother doesn't. Family members will give their opinion, but there's really no way to tell. We looked exactly the same.
Now, is your brother still with us, I hope?
Oh, yes, he is. Yes, he is. He lives in Santa Cruz, California, and we don't look the same now.
Okay.
I've become more handsome, and he just, I don't know what happened to him.
That happens sometimes. Well, the reason I ask that question is because, and this may have a unique perspective on it, because I've never asked a twin person this question, but normally at 5 years old, I think of that as the purest self. Because mm-hmm. that's before you start school and peer pressure begins to get added on and you start to become what the other students want you to be and especially right. what the teachers want you to be or what they don't want you to be.
Sure. So
can you tell us a little bit about the five-year-old David Leopold growing up in Pennsylvania?
I would love to. I don't have much recollection of it. My whole childhood is a wonderful sort of collage of really happy memories. I remember one time I was with Jules Pfeiffer and we were talking about something and I said, Jules, you'll never become a great artist or writer or anything. He says, what do you mean? You bring these books and you do this curating and it's really wonderful. I said, yeah, but I get along completely with my family. I love seeing my brothers and sisters. I'm close with my dad. My mom passed away about 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we're just a tight-knit group. And we've always been that way. And it wasn't because we didn't have other friends. It's just that, I was lucky to get the right parents. And we just had a great time all the time.
That's wonderful. I love hearing that. That's great. But as you started going through school, did you have any aspirations of what you wanted to do with your life? And when did the art world start to consume you or start to seep into your very being?
Well, when I was a teenager, I started thinking a lot about the arts, music. And I don't know about you. There was no theater. Theater was something you heard about. There was some community theater going on in Harrisburg, but we never went to that. Mm-hmm. My first Broadway show was in 1977, Frank Langella in Dracula.
Wow.
I went with a school group and it was fantastic. My second show was Dancing, which I had no idea what I was going to. Mm-hmm. And now I only wish I could go back there and watch it again. I just would be fascinated to see it.
Well, you might get a chance. I think they're going to bring it back to Broadway. They were scheduled to bring it back when COVID hit. So sure. It still happens.
Well, I'm sure it'll be great. It won't be the same.
Of course it won't.
Of that production. And when I first, introduced to New York City, it was like the New York Times for me coming alive. I'm sure you were the same way in this regard. I read every ad. I read every theater listing, I read those pages like they were like pages from the Bible and I had to know them. And it was a wonderful, and it led me to books. It led me to other publications.
Oh my God, you're describing my life.
exactly. I don't think I think there's many people like us, mm-hmm. I lived in a fairly gray world. It was, it was wonderful, but nothing ever happened in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I mean, as a teenager, when we started driving around, we would try to get lost, because it would be an adventure to try to get home. That's the only thing that was going on, and I wasn't, school theater didn't seem that interesting to me. I've never wanted to be a performer. But then I went, my parents, God love them. They wanted me to have a normal life. They didn't discourage my interest in the arts. But they certainly were not encouraging and like, hey, you should do that. But I ended up going to school and getting a degree in theater history and administration. And I really thought I'd be running a small theater in the Bay Area. So I'm a really abject failure in that regard. But luckily I started curating in college and that led to doing more work. And before I thought I was going to be managing director of a theater. And I was doing so many curatorial jobs that I realized, wait a second, I think I may be a curator. And then once I was conscious of it, then I started deciding, well, what do I want to do? Because I was just taking, people would come to me and say, well, could you do this or that? And so that's what I do now is, that's how I met Hirschfeld. I was working on an exhibition for the New York Public Library on theatrical illustration. Well, it was even earlier. I was doing some research on the artist Ben Soloway, who did charcoal portraits from life in the 1930s of Broadway film, dance, for the Times and the Herald Tribune. And I noticed that the clippings often had Hirschfeld's on the other side, or if they weren't cut out completely, they had Hirschfeld's right next to it. And, you know, a light bulb went off and I said, boy, I should contact Hirschfeld. He was in the phone book. And I was too scared to call because I thought, you know, I would have 16 functionaries who would tell me that I was not, you know, important enough to speak to the master. So I wrote him a letter and he invited me next time I was in Fun City to come up and quaff some tea. And he wrote a really one. I got the nicest note back from Al Hirschfeld that I ever got from anybody who was not a relative, you know, signed fraternally yours. I was 22 years old and it was like the greatest thing that had ever happened to me. So of course I figured out some reason to come to New York. I didn't need a reason. I had lots of research to do. I had a woman that I was dating who I eventually married and been married happily for 26 years. Thank you. So I called him up and said, I'm coming up. And he invited, we had tea and cookies at 4 o'clock, which was his thing. I met Dolly Haas, his wife, second wife, who he's married to for 51 years. And I left there thinking, boy, I've hit it off with Al Hirschfeld. I must be doing all right. I later discovered that everybody hit it off with Al Hirschfeld. He was just that kind of guy. You met him.
Yes.
The guy you met is the guy he was. I spent 13 years visiting him in his studio regularly. We went through a lot of things. The death of Dolly, lawsuits, new books, lots of openings. There was the person that you see in the drawings is the person who he was, mm-hmm. You know, they're an accurate reflection of who he was as an individual.
But I want to go back for a moment, the love of the theater. Mm-hmm. What was it that drew you? I mean, you had no desire to be an entertainer yourself. And there are people who love going to the theater for a lot of reasons. We know the right reasons to go to the theater, but it was deeper than that for you. What was that pull for you that you had that love of the theater?
I love live performance. There's being in the room, you know, to coin a phrase, the room where it happens.
Where it happens, yes.
Has always been, I went back to my first Broadway show last night. I saw The Girl from the North Country, totally recommend it to everybody. Lights go down. I'm there. I'm so excited. I've never lost that excitement. I have a joy. It brings me joy. I don't know if I need to explore why it brings me joy. You know, I like chocolate ice cream. Do I need to figure out why? No, I like it. Bring it more.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely.
And so that's what I decided. I don't know what told me as a young person to follow my joy, but that's what I did. And this far into it, I still can't believe I get to do this. I mean, I am the luckiest person you may ever meet.
And you mentioned that you had this 13-year relationship with Hirschfeld. Mm-hmm. Could you have ever imagined that you would find yourself in the position that you have now? And if you can just give us a Reader's Digest version, because you've done so much of the road that led you to where you are right now.
I never imagined it. If you had told the kid in Harrisburg that he would be friends with Al Hirschfeld, it just didn't seem possible. You know, it was a series of happy coincidences. You know, he at that moment was looking for someone to organize the archive of his work. He lived in the present. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't go to the revival of Showboat. You know, Harold Prince did a revival of Showboat. What, 94 or something? Yeah. And he didn't go to it thinking, you know, he had seen every Broadway iteration of Showboat to that point. He had drawn all but the very first one. he didn't go to it and think, boy, it's not as good as 27 or 46 or 32. He didn't think in those terms. He thought about how does it work today? How is a good theater? You know, mm-hmm. he saw it in context of the now rather than the past. And he really, I remember one time I was up in the studio and an old press agent came up, and Al drew every day. I mean, mm-hmm. that was who he was. He was in the barber chair. He was drawing at the table. This press agent comes in. I'm in another part of the studio doing what I do, you know, cataloging things, discovering things. That was like King Tut's tomb for me. There was just everything. And everything, what I thought Al Hirschfeld was a pack rat because there were tons of old magazines in there. And then I discovered they all had Hirschfeld drawings in them. He had been throwing them on a pile for years. And, you know, sometimes he would write on the front of the magazine the page number that his drawing was in. And it was every publication you can think of. I mean, it's a much shorter list of publications he didn't appear in the 20th century. So when I came on the scene, it was when somebody said to him, well, what about you did it? Have you ever drawn this? Or, you know, when did you do that? He didn't have any interest in that. He would say, oh, I have an archivist now and he's organized everything. And that means I can't find everything. So you'll have to ask him. And so it was a way of him just outsourcing that part of his life because he would rather be drawing. Mm-hmm. And for me, I loved it. And that's what we talked about. We talked about art and the theater. You know, we spent a lot of time. I mean, that's when we were working, we didn't spend a lot of time talking, but at lunchtime, he had tea and cookies every day at 4. And, you know, lunch was like an hour long. And, you know, you talked about what was happening today. And then I would be like, or even when he was working, I would bring over something and say, well, what's this? And he would lean back in his chair and I could see the smile come on his face. And he's like, oh, so where did you find this? That was the most often heard expression. And a story would tumble out. And he was not a braggart per se, but he was a great raconteur. And some of these stories I know that he hadn't told in years, if ever. And we ended up having this vocabulary of his drawings because I could mention a 1932 drawing and he knew exactly what I was talking about. Or he would mention some obscure piece. And I would say, oh, yeah. Well, like, it's like this. Or, you know, I don't know how to explain that. It was a language that he and I shared. And it wasn't, I mean, I love looking for Nina as much as the next person. But it had nothing to do with that. It had everything to do with drawing, with the performance, with, the characters. He loved characters. And that's why he had a great, you know, his friendship with Carol Channing was legendary. She claimed that he is the one that made her a star. Mm-hmm. She was in this review, Lend an Ear, and Al did a drawing, a theme drawing of husbands and wives on Broadway, and he included Carol in it. And then he did supporting players numbers who stopped the show, and there was the performer who sings Bally High in South Pacific. And I forget all the people who are in it, but there's Carol Channing as the Magnolia Girl. The Gladiola Girl, I'm sorry. She said all of a sudden everybody started coming to the show. And Julie Stein and Anita Loos saw her in that drawing and said, that's our Lorelei.
That's right.
But beyond that, they literally became great friends because Al was not a larger than life character like Carol was, but he was totally at home with those people. Mm-hmm. And they were with him. They recognized a kindred spirit. And so they would drive places and be singing at the top of their lungs the whole time. He told me one time they had to drive to someplace in Ohio and they spent the whole time just singing out loud, you know, I can't imagine it, but I can totally imagine it. You know, Al was somebody who would get in the car and drive to Florida for dinner. You know, he did that once and his host said, where are you staying? He says, oh, I'm driving back home tonight. And he did. He drove back.
Did you ever have any downtime? Because it seems, you know, when I think of him, I think of every night being at the theater. And when he's not at the theater, I think of him sitting in the barber chair unless he was having coffee and tea, I mean, tea and cookies, that he would always be drawing.
That's what he was doing. No, it wasn't work to him. He loved to draw. He had found a way to make it pay. And he was surprised at that. And he learned not to question it too much. He learned just to commit to working on the best drawing he could. Mm-hmm. But he loved it, so it wasn't work. And going to the theater or music or going to a party at a friend's house, I mean, this is a man who at 99 was still doing all those things. A friend of his told me that the only difference between Al at 29 and 99 is that his hair was white, where it used to be black. But he was and when he wasn't going out someplace, he would have people in. And this wasn't like a short-term thing. We have all of his appointment books, you know, his calendars. And it's amazing. You know, it's every night. And it was a lot of theater. But like I said, he saw a lot of music, saw all kinds of things, dance. You know, he was into it. He really took advantage of the situation that he was in a very positive way. You know, he loved going to shows. And he, I think, also still had that sort of wide-eyed, born in St. Louis wonder when going to the theater. You know, he was literally always amazed. People amazed him, you know, and he would declare something insane, but that was a good thing. You know, if he said something was insane, you know that it had met his approval. And he liked doing he liked drawing the theater because, as he said, it allowed him to sleep late.
And when did the transition happen for you, when it went, when it transitioned from being a friendship to being a career for you with the Hirschfeld Foundation?
Oh, boy. When I first started working with Hirschfeld, the friendship in almost immediately after that first visit for tea, I got invited to be his archivist. And I was 24, he was 86, and I thought it might last 2 years. And the deal was that it was going to be very informal, that I would call him up and say, hey, are you free Tuesday or Wednesday? I can come up those days. And of course, he almost always was. Mm-hmm. And I would come up, I'd park right in front of his house on 95th Street. He had fairy dust, I'm convinced of it. That is a man who could drive a Cadillac into Times Square and find a parking spot in front of the theater. And it happened for decades. And he must have sprinkled it on me because I found parking spots. Whenever I was doing something with him, I always found a parking spot. When he died, it stopped. I was shocked. Even on his own block.
A friend of mine refers to it as Doris Day parking. No, because in all of her movies, if she's driving a car, she would pull up in front of a building, get out of the car.
Yes.
Never in front of there was never a parking meter or a fire hydrant ever. She would pull up in front of a building, get out of the car, walk up. And that's exactly what you're describing right now.
Yeah. No, it was one time his car was in the shop and he lived on 95th between Park and Lexington, 122 East 95th Street. And he got his car serviced on 12th Avenue, like 57th Street. And one day at the end of the day, he asked if I would drive him over to pick up his car. And I said, yeah, sure. And so we drove over there. And what was so amazing about driving around with Al is we'd see something and that would start a story. You know, I would ask him a question. I'm like, oh, what about? And he would tell me some funny story. So we're laughing the whole way over there. And we get to 57th Street, which is four lanes. And I'm on the opposite side of the street of the garage. And I said, well, look, let me turn around so I can drop you off right in front. He's like, oh, don't worry. And he opens up the door. It's four lanes of traffic. This was like 5 o'clock. It's very busy and the traffic's moving. It's not backed up. It's moving. And Al Hirschfeld walked across the street. I saw this. He walked out like Mr. Magoo. Car is whizzing high, and he just seemed to walk through it.
I can see it happening.
Yeah. And this, you know, it was like watching Santa Claus cross the street. It was just not to be believed. And that was Al. You know, he could go to the corner and come back and have a great story to tell. Just because William Saroyan one time said that wherever Al went, somebody was always trying to offer him the key to something. And he was kind of right. I mean, he had this kind of charisma that attracted people.
And Carol Channing, of course. Yeah. I mean, anywhere you went, anywhere with her, it was the same thing. Did you ever go to the theater with him?
I was at shows that he was at, but we never went together because, you know, even in the year between Dolly and when he married Louise Kurz, mm-hmm. you know, he was the most eligible bachelor in New York. There were all of his women who would have loved to be the next Mrs. Al Hirschfeld. And not, I mean, he was 95 at the time. The idea that he would be looking for somebody, he wasn't really, but then he needed someone. He was a very social person and needed a companion. And he had known Louise for years. So I never went to the theater with him, but when we were at shows together, when we were at shows that we both ended up at, sometimes to our surprise, because we didn't say, oh, I'm going to this tonight or I'm going to that tonight. Mm-hmm. We would see each other and it was always like, you know, fancy meeting you here. And then of course we'd always talk about the next day, you know. I remember like Carol's last time doing Hello Dolly in New York. I was up having lunch the next day at the house and I said, well, how was she? She said, oh, he said, as soon as she came on stage, you knew you were in safe hands, you know? And I would thought, okay, you know, how many times he had seen Carol do Hello Dolly? Probably dozens, mm-hmm. you know, in every iteration that she had ever done it. And there he was seeing it again. And it was like the first time he had seen it.
And did you ever go out socially beyond going to the theater? I mean, you running into each other at the theater, but did you ever have social occasions that you were at a party or an event together?
You know, I look back on it now and I was pretty young, and being pretty young in New York, even with someone like Hirschfeld, he was pretty old mm-hmm. and he was doing things that older people did. And I was doing things that younger people did. And like I said, we would exchange notes when we would see each other. But it wasn't until much later that if I was in town for a while, I had sublet my apartment and he would find out that, you know, I was going to stay over at a friend's place or something. He's like, why don't you stay here? And so I would stay at the house or we'd go out to dinner but you know, it was our lunches. And I mean, I have the record for the most free lunches at the home of Al Hirschfeld. Very proud of that. Very good food served there. I would recommend it to all my friends. And then sometimes I would bring people if I met somebody interesting that I thought would abuse Al, I would bring them. I would say, you know, can I invite a friend to lunch? And of course he was always game. People excited Al Hirschfeld. He was into it. And then sometimes I would meet somebody well-known and I would think, oh, they'd like to meet Al Hirschfeld and Al would probably like to meet them. I remember bringing Stanley Tucci up to Al's house for lunch when Stanley did the Joe Gould movie. And this is, mid-90s. And Al was, I don't know if you know who Joe Gould was.
Yes.
Professor Siegel, a man who was writing the history of the United States based on overheard conversation. And he supported himself by getting a dollar each week from 50 different people. One of those people was Al Hirschfeld. And Al would usually invite him in for dinner because, sure, why not? You know, it's just a character that he would have. And of course, Gould always had some funny story, you know, some crazy thing that had happened to him. And I said to Stanley, I said, would you like to meet somebody who knew Joe Gould? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love that. And I said, it's Al Hirschfeld. He's like, you're kidding. And what was so funny when I would bring somebody like Stanley up there, they would turn into fanboys. Mm-hmm. You know, they would often have a book or two with them. You know, Mr. Hirschfeld, could you sign this? You know, and of course, Al was always completely game for it, you know, and we'd go up to the studio and because the studio's on the top floor of his house. And, you know, he would it was a fun time. And then, you know, inevitably, once the person was there for a while, Al would get back to drawing and we'd still keep talking. And people were amazed that he could keep up his end of the conversation while he was producing, you know, a great work of art. But that's who Al was. I'd started to tell you about this old press agent that had come up to see Al. He was up there and he was reminiscing with all these crazy things that the two of them had done and people that they had known. And after about an hour, the guy left. And Al, in all seriousness, turns to me and he says, "I don't get these guys who just want to think about the past." Like, he was perplexed by it. And he went back to drawing because that wasn't who he was. He was interested in what was happening then. He saw all of his friends, you know, rise, have their moment, and decline. And he just kept going. He just kept on having, you know, this is a man who had an audience in the millions when he was 25, and he only got more popular. All while doing it completely on his own terms. You know, he said that he didn't really understand why people liked the work, because when he first started doing it, you know, he said editors would complain. And then all of a sudden he got accolades and it was the same drawings that he was doing. So he just learned to trust himself is really what it came
to. Well, this amazing, you know, and I think of it as alchemy. I mean, it couldn't be anything, but I mean, his relationship at the time with the New York Times. And you talk about it. I talked about it in my introduction of, you know, all across the country, kids growing up at the time that we grew up, grabbing the New York Times on a Sunday, seeing those caricatures in the New York Times. We don't have anything like that now.
It's true. I think everybody knew more about Broadway during Al's career than in any other time, because everybody looked at the drawings and they were the drawings of a show that was going to open that week. I mean, you have to remember, when Al drew Guys and Dolls, he didn't know if it was going to be a big hit or a flop. And that wasn't important to him. That's not what he wasn't there to judge. But his drawings appeared the Sunday before it opened. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's great drawings of shows you've never heard of, but they're great drawings. I've lost my train of thought. I apologize.
No, that's all right. I mean, we're talking about the impact that he had on theater kids around the country, or people who had this love of theater. And I'm also certain that those drawings impacted ticket sales of people coming to New York, because they knew from a Herschel drawing, it didn't matter whether it was a hit or not. Herschel drew it.
Right. It looked interesting. I want to go. And Broadway doesn't have that. And I love Squiggs and Ken Fallon, and they're fantastic. Don't get me wrong. They don't have the platform. You know, Al was lucky to have a career at the time of sort of the golden age of illustration. And we think of his work in the Times, and he was in that paper on average every other week for 75 years. Mm-hmm. That represents less than half the work he did. You know, while we were seeing him in the Times, we were also seeing him on record covers, on TV guides. You'd pick up a magazine, there'd be a Hirschfeld. I mean, we lived in a great age where, you know, you would really have to go out of your way not to see a Hirschfeld.
Talk about all the work that he did for Broadway, but he also was very much a part of the Hollywood golden era. Definitely. You know, the work that he did, for MGM. And, if you go back and you look at a lot of the MGM poster art, there's a lot of Herschel's Wizard of Oz.
Yes, exactly.
Drawings and everything. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about two areas before we end up getting to the end of our program. And the first thing is really about Herschel's U season. Mm-hmm. If you can go back, starting with 1977, when Herschfeld started putting together these montages, if you will, or collages of what the new Broadway season would look like and how that all came about.
And well, it was more than Broadway. It was when he did those new season drawings starting in 77, it was Broadway, film, television, music, dance, art. Very few places you're going to see Cezanne, Richard Pryor, and Neil Young together. Mm-hmm. But you saw it in a Herschfeld new season drawing.
And where did that come from? I mean, was this an idea that he came up with, or was he approached to do this from someone at the Times? Was that his brainchild? Where did this all come from? Or do you know what the genesis was for this?
I don't know. Well, he, as we show in our new online exhibition, Hirschfeld's New Season, he had been doing versions of this since 1931. He also did, I don't have them because they're not New Season drawings, but in 1955, he did this mural for the Fifth Avenue Cinema. This would have been on Fifth Avenue and 12th Street. Mm-hmm. It was all the people at the movies. You know, it was like the history of film. And it was, you had the table full of villains and the table of comedians.
Oh, very famous. Leading ladies. I know them, yes.
Yeah, it's a great piece. It's, you know, it's iconic in that way. So there were always these composite drawings. He would, oftentimes a publication or sometimes a studio like United Artists would commission a drawing of the Oscar nominees. And again, it was this composite. It wasn't done in the same way that those New Season drawings were done, but he was bringing together lots of people. And so, of course, when the Times decided to do those New Season sections, I think primarily because they would be a good place for advertisements, because advertising in the arts and leisure section was the most profitable advertising that Times had at that time. And so big ads for the new show opening or the new exhibition or the new film, that was gold for the New York Times. And so that's, I'm sure, what spurred on that new section. Well, if you're going to talk about the arts and you're the New York Times, who else would you go to? And when they gave him the first assignment, they didn't tell him, you didn't tell Hirschfeld what to do. There was no point in telling her. In fact, when I would see our art directors sometimes give, you know, they would tell Al very specific things and he would look at the note and he would say, well, I'm not doing that. And he would go ahead and do what he wanted. Or if he did what they wanted, it was never as good as what he would have wanted to do. And if you look at those New Season drawings, those are really remarkable portraits that are fully integrated in with everything else. You know, they're like threads in a tapestry. Individually, they're beautiful. Together, they're even more beautiful. And I was talking recently with Connie Rosenblum, who edited the Arts and Leisure section for about 10 years that overlapped some of this period. And she said it was always a huge topic of discussion of what names they would give out. And they were all ridiculously excited to see what would come out. You know, and that was true of almost all the drawings that he did for the Times. The arrival of the Hirschfeld drawing at the New York Times was a time that everyone stopped and went to take a look at it to see, you know, maybe they, a lot of those people counted Nina's from the original drawing, you know, and so everyone would look at it and then they would take it to be photographed. The Times was so scared that something would happen to the drawing that they would make full-size reproductions of it almost as soon as they got it. And the great thing for us is that when they returned the drawing to Al, they would often give him the reproductions that they had made. So we have these full-size vintage reproductions of thousands of drawings from about 1955 to about 1997. And then after that, it was all digital.
And of course, he's irreplaceable. I mean, with all due respect to everyone else who does this, you mentioned Squiggs and Ken Fallon, both who I'm huge fans of.
Right.
But once Hirschfeld was no longer doing his work and he, you know, passed on, there was never a continuation of that tradition in the New York Times.
Or anywhere else. You know, there's nothing like Hirschfeld beforehand. He came up during a vogue for caricature, but within a few years, he was caricature. You know, in mid-century America, if you wanted something like a caricature, you called Hirschfeld. And if he couldn't do it, you called somebody else. But literally, he so dominated the field. And he was a relative latecomer to caricature. You know, caricature and the caricature that he did was not the boardwalk caricature. You know, it wasn't pejorative. It wasn't poking fun at, I mean, humor was involved, but it wasn't at the expense of the subject. It was If it was a comedy, it was a fun drawing. Mm-hmm. You know, if it was a drama, you know, when you look at Long Day's Journey to Night, it's not pulling its leg. It was very sincere in its appreciation of what he was seeing. And he really was a visual journalist. And when he would go to see shows out of town or in previews, he was so focused on what was going on stage, he didn't know what was actually going on in the show. He was looking for movement and gesture that would be the identifying moments of the show, you know, because he would do these cast drawings that are full of all this activity, never told you the plot, you know, didn't ruin anything. There were no spoiler alerts required for Hirschfeld's work, yet you felt like you were seeing the show.
Absolutely. Well, I have to ask you, I have a few friends who actually commissioned him to do Hirschfeld sure. themselves, and they're hanging in their living rooms.
Right.
You have a Hirschfeld.
I do not have a Hirschfeld. And that is my fault, not Al's fault. If I had asked him at any time that I knew him, he would have done it. I felt, you know, and sometimes I remember one time I was up there and a guy writes in trying to impress Al, and he's a very important clothing manufacturer somewhere in the Midwest, and he's a big fan of his work. And it was always funny when he said, I'm a big fan of your work. I see it in the New Yorker all the time. Well, he had been famously banned from the New Yorker in 1937 up until 1993. Yes. So when someone said that, I'm sure Al felt the same way, red flag. And they would say, I love your work. I'm your biggest fan. Could you draw me a Liza Minnelli, you know, or something like that? And now I would write back, I'm so glad, you know, this is a variation and I'm paraphrasing. I'm so glad to have met my biggest fan. You know, you seem like such a wonderful person. I'll be happy to send you a Liza Minnelli caricature. I would like a suit in blue and one in brown, you know. And of course, I know what the reaction was on the other end, just like he knew. They would be like, well, you know, that costs money.
Of course.
You know, so I never wanted to be one of those people. The only argument I ever got into with Al Hirschfeld was over drawing. I had had a good year and I decided, hey, I want a Hirschfeld drawing, not necessarily of myself. I'm not vain in that regard, but I would see, I mean, I held in my hand incredible drawings all the time. And there was this one from a show you've never heard of called The Show Is On. It's just it's a pas de deux. It's a great, great image. And I knew that he liked it. It was in several of his books. And I had a good year and I brought the drawing over to the drawing table. I said, listen, I'd like to buy this. You tell me what the price is. I think I can afford to buy it. But if I can't, I will pay, I'll pay in installments. You keep the drawing. And, you know, he takes a look at it. He's like, oh, this is a nice drawing. And I'm thinking, the price just went up. I'm screwed. And he's like, I want you to have it. I said, Al, I can't take it. You know, I do a lot of work with museums. I've done a lot of museum shows of Al's work. You can't profit from it. If you were, that would compromise me to a museum person. And I explained this to him. He's like, well, I want you to have it. And I can't take it. No, you must take it. I can't take it. We were almost raising our voices. Louise came in and said, boys, what's going on here? And he said, David's gone crazy. He won't take my gift. And she says, well, it's decided then. You'll take the gift. And I did. I mean, it was really.
And where does it hang in your house?
Oh, it hangs right where I can see it every day.
Oh, that's
great.
On the
first floor. I have a couple of original Hirschfeld drawings. That one I got from him, but I bought others over the years. And that's not true. I have a Hirschfeld watercolor that he gave me. I have a couple of prints that he gave me. You know, he was very generous with me and with everybody. And because you can see by his drawings, he's a generous guy. You know, he would highlight people like Carol who were supporting players. But to him, they were as important as anybody else in the production.
That's right. And that's a very important thing to point out. And I'm glad you did that. Again, before we run out, this incredible exhibit is online for anyone to be able to go and watch. And all the details are going to be right on YouTube. Watch this video. It's right underneath. Was this your idea to do this online this season, or?
Yes. I wanted to do, you know, when we started, we're a pandemic success story. When the pandemic started, we knew that we would not have the ability to do shows. I knew pretty much right away that this was not the end of something. It was the beginning of something, and it was going to go on for a while. And I actually thought we were going to have to close down the foundation. And the board said, no, we want you to keep working. So within 3 weeks of the Broadway shutdown, we had created this digital platform to present exhibitions. And our first show was one on solo shows called Socially Distant Theater. And I wanted to make it, you know, when you're dealing with artwork that is now getting older every day, you know, you want to make it relevant for audiences today. And so I was really thinking about, you know, all the shows opening up again for the, you know, a new season turns out to be an incredible thing. I mean, when any year it's great, but when you haven't had one for 2 years is really great. And so I thought that's what we should do. We should do something on that. So I had the idea, and then I had to say, look, I can think of that 1970, those new season drawings that I did for the Times in the 70s and 80s were the first thing that I thought of, but 10 of those would be pretty boring. I mean, they're not going to be boring, but what am I going to say about them? So I started looking through our database, which anybody can do by going online. You can look for drawings by performer, by production, by publication, by date, by theater season, by year. I mean, we try to make it as easy as possible. And I started going through it, and I started looking for drawings that told these stories, not just of the new, those new season ones were of all the arts. He did ones of just theater. His last, quote, new season drawing was of six leading ladies who would be on Broadway that season, which included Carol and Julie Andrews and Carol Burnett. That 95 season was pretty amazing. Zoe Caldwell.
I think I may have that queued up here. I may be able to show that.
That would be terrific.
Let's see if I have that one here.
Uta Hagen, Elizabeth Ashley are all in that drawing. And it's just, I don't know, those names still I'm in awe of.
I'll share a funny story with you. Do you know the story of, you know, Marge Champion discovered Carol Channing? Do you know the story? When they were casting Linda Neer, she went to pick up Carol, and she was driving Carol to the theater, and she says, well, what exactly do you do? And Carol says, well, I do impressions. And Marge says, well, like who? And she said, Uta Hagen. And Marge said, Uta Hagen? Who does Uta Hagen? I want to ask you before we begin to wrap up, what life lesson did you learn from Hirschfeld that impacted you as a human being, and a life lesson that impacted the work that you do, whether it be work that you do for the foundation or work that you do in all endeavors of the work that you do?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint one thing. I've been very fortunate to know a lot of extraordinary people, some well-known, some not. And Al was, you know, he was a life lover. You know, I saw him go through the toughest times, some of the toughest times of his life. And, you know, when Dolly died, I was really concerned for him. Mm-hmm. And at first I thought he was heartless. He was just back drawing right away. But I realized that was who he was. And he was living in the present. And that's the way she was. Like I said, that idea of living in the present is really hard for people. And especially as we age, there's this tendency, you know, you get together with old friends and a lot of them do want to talk about the past. And you might have had some wonderful times in the past. But if you're not having wonderful times now, it's really, you know, I'm not planning to shuffle off this mortal coil anytime soon. And so you've got to keep creating new, wonderful experiences. And so that was very much something that I saw in Al. This is going to sound presumptuous, but it's kind of what we saw in each other. You know, he was very committed to what he did, and he was a genius. You know, that was you know, he had that special something that he was a genius. But there's a lot of people who do are, you know, you're doing what you love to do.
Absolutely.
And I'm doing what I love to do. But I'm surprised. I have a son. He's now 19 years old. I was surprised when he was younger and you're really spending a lot of time with other parents. Almost all the parents, certainly almost all the fathers, were doing jobs that they hated. And they did it all every day. And they were going to be doing it for another 25 years.
Looking for retirement.
They live their life for retirement. And then they fall over dead when they retire. And I never understood that. I mean, look, if a car hits me today, I will be disappointed, not for the things that I should have done, but the things that I haven't gotten around to doing just because it's another day, do what you love. As I've got a son now who's at that stage in his life deciding what he wants to do, you know, everyone tells them schools should be about getting a job. And I'm like, it's about learning as much as you possibly can. You know, this is the time and you will figure out your job later. You know, just learn and live, learn, love, and then everything else will come into being.
Absolutely. I'm glad you said that. Before we sign off, one of my favorite shows was Inside the Actor's Studio with James Lipton, and
he always ended
his show with his questions. So I've got some random questions.
Okay, good.
To wind up. And the first question is, who in life have you felt the strongest need to protect? And you probably have already told us about him.
What? Who do I feel the need to, for the strongest need to protect?
Protect in life.
Well, probably, you know, obviously my family, my son that's a very big part. But, you know, I'm not so worried about protecting him. He's taller than me. He's smarter than me. And he's more handsome than me at any age. So I'm not so worried about him. I do worry about people I don't know that are suffer every day indignities because we live in a world that somehow feels like we shouldn't look after our fellow person. You know, I've never understood that. And so I do spend a lot of time. Look, we have a whole arts education program from the foundation that we created with the New York City Board of Education to bring arts education to kids who do not get it, you know, and because schools think arts, we can't pay money for an arts teacher. Mm-hmm. So we've created a full curriculum that's for theater, music, visual arts, dance, and from K to 12. And we're getting it into schools. We did this whole pilot program right before the pandemic with six really underserved schools in the Syracuse area. And the response was so incredible.
That's just great.
So incredible. And so I feel like those are the people we need to protect and encourage and support. You know, I protect and support maybe are interchangeable for me.
That's wonderful. What would you be best at were you to change careers?
I think I would be a very good ticket taker. I think I would be an excellent usher.
Okay.
I'm very familiar with theaters. I know what the audience experience should be like. I would be a very good usher.
Okay. Whose brain power have you found most intimidating in this business that you're in?
Just about everybody else.
Good answer. What is the hardest thing to forgive in your profession?
Hardest thing to forgive? Don't really think in those terms. It upsets me when... I can't take rudeness. That bothers me to no end. When people are rude to each other for whatever reason, you know, they think they know more than you or whatever. That bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why it does. It just does.
Well, I'm with you.
Mm-hmm.
What is the job that you've had in your career that you've enjoyed the least?
I don't take those jobs.
I love you. That's great. What issues are you most hypocritical about in your profession?
That I'm hypocritical about? Well, so I go to a number of museum exhibitions, and that's a busman's holiday for me. And I always feel that I could do better.
Okay, good for you.
But when I see them, of course, I tell them how great they are. But I often wonder, like, why did you do that? And I would have put it over here, and, you know, that type of thing.
What is the one thing about your profession that you love the most?
Well, creating something that people love. You know, when I whether it's an online exhibition or an in-person exhibition, when you can gather together art that will inspire or validate somebody, that is a great, great feeling. You know, I'm behind the artist because the artist really is done that. But when I put it all together, and sometimes I've got a show on right now of a regional painter in a museum in Pennsylvania, and it's very, very satisfying to me that the show is exact. He didn't know how the show was going to be. And I had this with Hirschfeld. They didn't know how the show was going to be. But when it's all put together, they're like, oh, I wouldn't have done this any other way. And, you know, and that's a great feeling and something I love to do.
That's wonderful. What do you think is the best thing about your profession? And perhaps you've just answered that question.
I think I just answered it.
And this is the
last. I hope I answered the last question.
Yes, and I'm going to. You have, and this is the last question I'm going to ask. What is the one thing about your work that makes you the proudest? And perhaps you've answered that as well.
Well, yes, all those things that I said. And then there's also the other group of artists that I work with are the historic artists, the ones who are no longer here. Where I'll work, I'm never going to do a Picasso show. Not that I wouldn't want to do it and maybe even have something to say, but Picasso doesn't need me. But the underappreciated artists that have had a career and passed away and are forgotten, to bring them back to life, and just as importantly, to have their family see the validation of people appreciating their father, typically, or their grandfather, sometimes a mother or grandmother. That's a great, great, some of the happiest times that I've had because they, you know, they know it's been great. They just didn't have a way to share it with others.
That's great. David, don't go anywhere for a moment. I want to thank everybody that tuned in today. Sure. I'm sure I can speak for David when I say this. Those of us who do what we do, in the arts, we don't take it lightly when you decide to spend a little time with us. So thank you for spending the last hour with us. If you popped in for a few minutes, if you spent the whole hour with us, thank you for stopping
by. And you're still awake.
And you're still awake. No, I truly had a great time. I hope you had as much fun, David, as I did. If this was your first time here, there's a little button on my banner and it says, join the celebration. I got rid of the word subscribe because to me, the word subscribe is a faceless entity. And I think of this as a celebration. I've celebrated over 300 other artists and hopefully there'll be 300 more, including David, that will celebrate even more. Please hit the join the celebration button. Leave a comment on today's show. Share this with your friends and followers. Please check out Hirschfeld's new season. It's great. It's really a lot of fun. It will bring back a lot of memories, some of that you are going to be familier with. Count the Ninas. They're all there. You'll have a lot of fun with it. And tell your friends about it. I also end every show by telling everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. Go to your Facebook friends list and reach out to the third name on your list and reach out with a phone call, not an email message, not a text message, right, not a private inbox message, a phone call, and let that person know what they mean to you. Because as my dear friend David Friedman always says, we're all in this together, but we're not in the same boat. And I always say, if you're going to go out in a boat, make sure you bring a skipper along. David, I'm actually going to leave the screen and I'm going to give you the final word. Anything that we've talked about today that you want to build upon, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish we had, or just any message that you want to put out to anyone who's watching right now, I thank you for the gifts that you've given to the world and that you're going to continue to give through the work that you're doing. I hope that I've celebrated your body of worth today. I hope that you will continue to stay in touch. Thank you for being here. And don't worry about how to end the show. As soon as you say goodbye, I will end the show. Thank you for being here today. And let's stay in touch, please.
You got it. Thank you, Richard. Well, that's one of the first things I want to say is thank you, Richard. I love that he has put together a celebration of life and people, because that's really what it's all about. At the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, go to alhirschfeldfoundation.org. If you like Hirschfeld, you will see as much as you want to see and a lot that you didn't even know existed. We put on exhibitions there. If you are fascinated by Nina, we have a whole exhibition. This time last year was the 75th anniversary of the very first Nina. You can follow us on Twitter at Al Hirschfeld, on Facebook at Al Hirschfeld Foundation, and on Instagram. And we have a whole online store because, you know, it's 2021. And right now this month we're running special offers each week for selected groups of limited edition hand-signed Hirschfeld prints. And you can save hundreds, if not thousands of dollars by visiting our website and learn what the promo codes are on our social media channels. And if I don't know what else to tell you other than Al Hirschfeld would have been having a good time no matter if we were at the tail end of a pandemic or not. And I think you should go out and have a good time. I know I certainly am. Thank you, Richard, for having me. And I'm looking forward to watching you celebrate with the next person.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.